I am so glad that you are here this morning. Welcome to Mill Creek. If you are listening online, we're glad that you are there with us. But we're excited to be together this morning. It's fun to dedicate kids, and they did great. There was no craziness that happened up here, and you're never quite sure how that's all going to go. But we appreciate our families. We appreciate our moms this morning, and we're just glad that you are with us today. We've been in a conversation over the last couple of weeks here at Mill Creek. We like to teach like in a series because it just helps us kind of organize our thoughts and keep us kind of on track and on pace. And so over the last couple of weeks, we've been in a little bit of a conversation looking at an issue of belief that we've all had, some probably exposure to, the idea of what it means to be saved. What does that mean to be saved? We hear around, we hang around church people and we hear that word salvation. We hear the word heaven. There's a lot of us that have opinions about that. Hollywood has opinions about heaven. We see some of those opinions in TV shows and movies. What's heaven like? What is that? Is there a heaven? Is it just a good place? Some of us, if we were to describe heaven, it might remind us a little bit of Florida, gated communities, golf every day, on the beach, kind of one of those pictures. And so, what does that even really mean? And so over the last couple of weeks, we've been talking a little bit through that and not just trying to figure out, what we believe, but what did Jesus say about those things? What did Jesus say about salvation? What did Jesus say about heaven? And it's kind of all come from a book that I started reading with a group of gentlemen that I'm a part of, a small group. Is the author of that book is John Ortberg, pastor out in California. And the name of the book is Eternity Is Now in Session. And I've shared with that with you every week. If you're a reader, it's a great book to grab a hold of. If you're looking for something to read, I would highly encourage you to grab a hold of it. It's easy to read. John takes a theologian whose name's Dallas Willard, who's very deep and very theological, and John takes his words and thoughts and he makes them a lot easier for us to understand as it relates to this idea of salvation and heaven and what did Jesus really teach and what did he really say. And what we discover as we kind of tear into this is that Jesus had a lot to say about it. And for Jesus, it was more than just a transaction. Salvation was more than just pray a certain prayer, say some words, cross a line, and you're in. Sign your name on a dotted line, and hopefully you made it. And then that creates a little bit of confusion for us because we start to ask, what are the minimum requirements? And we talk through that. And every group of people, churches, denominations, they kind of have their own list. And did I pray the prayer right? And then I mess up a little bit in life and, do I need to pray it again? And it kind of just messes with us a little bit. And what we discover in what Jesus taught, when Jesus would talk about this idea, Jesus talked about it not just as a place, not just as, something you try to get into, but Jesus talked about the idea of heaven now, his kingdom now. He would talk about a kingdom that wasn't just a kingdom for down the road somewhere, maybe one day when we die, whatever, but that there was a part of that kingdom that exists and can exist in our life today. And so what we've discovered, kind of the overarching theme of this conversation over these last couple of weeks, is simply that salvation isn't about getting into heaven. It's about getting heaven into us, that the way we live our life, the way we make our choices, the way we do relationships, that you and I actually can bring a little bit of heaven into this broken world, that it's not just waiting for one day. It's not just hoping that I crossed the line, I did it right, I said the right words, I prayed the right prayer. It is a decision. There is a moment of decision, but it's so much more than just signing a paper. Like we sign our mortgage, and we fill out all the paperwork and yay, now we own a home and we're in. That it's so much more than that. That it's not just getting somewhere, but it's actually getting a little bit of heaven into us. And so last week, as we worked through this, the natural part of this conversation then is, well, who's in? How do you get in? Like, we want to know who's in. And what we worked through last week, as a quick moment of review, we talked a little bit about labels. We talked a little bit about how we sometimes identify ourselves. And oftentimes you hang around with church people, they like that label Christian. And, so we throw that word out there, Christian, you got to be a Christian. There's Christian music. There's Christian this, there's Christian that. It's this label we kind of throw out there. And what we find is that Jesus never used that label. Jesus never taught anyone how to be a Christian. He never taught anyone, here's how you pray to become a Christian. In fact, and I know this might upset some of you, don't get mad at me, just jump online, grab last week's podcast. Jesus himself was not a Christian. He wasn't. He was a Jewish rabbi. And so Jesus had other terms that he used. And there's another term that is used all throughout the New Testament, and it's the word disciple. Jesus called people to be his disciple. He called people to be his student, to be a learner, to be an apprentice. Jesus called people to be a follower. These were the words that Jesus used, and he painted a picture. Christian is so ambiguous. Because you can be with a different group of people, a different denomination, a different church, and they have their idea of what a Christian is, and then you go somewhere else, and then they have their idea, and it's very ambiguous, and Jesus never used those terms, but he talked about what it meant to be a disciple, and the invitation of Jesus that he offered to people was a very simple invitation. He just invited them to follow him. He just said, come follow me. And so then the question for our life is very simple. The question of our life is, am I following Jesus? Am I following him? By definition, if Jesus invites us to follow him, that means he becomes the leader of our life. By definition, if I'm following somebody, I'm letting them lead me. I'm going where they go. The word disciple was a simple Greek word. There was nothing religious about it. It was not a word that was used in religious circles. It just meant to be a student, a learner, an apprentice. Am I learning from him? Am I following him? Am I letting him lead me? Do I make choices and decisions based on where Jesus would want me to do that? Am I saying yes to Jesus? Am I taking the next step in following Jesus? And that becomes the question of our life. I'm a sinner. I messed up. I've made mistakes in my life. I can't follow Jesus. Actually, what we discover, it's a prerequisite to be messed up before you become a follower of Jesus. That's who Jesus invited to follow him. It wasn't the put together. It wasn't the ones that had it all figured out. It was the ones who had everything messed up. He invites them to follow him. I don't know if I can believe all of that. None of his followers believed everything at the start. None of his followers understood everything. It was the process. It was the relationship that he invited them to, that it was through that they learned. It was through that they grew. It was through that that they began the process of being a student and an apprentice of Jesus. And so the question that we have to ask ourselves in our life is, am I following Jesus? Because that's the invitation that he gives us. And so what we discover in the way that Jesus talks about this idea of salvation in heaven, we discover that it's more than just a place, that it's actually something that in my everyday life, in the choices of my life, in the decisions of my life, how I do relationships, every single time that I'm willing to forgive somebody in a relational context, I'm inviting a little bit of heaven into this world. I have the right to get even. I have the right to be angry. But every time I make the choice to do as Jesus teaches us to do, I'm bringing a little bit of heaven into a very broken and messed up world. Every time I choose not to be angry, all of these choices that I make in my life is bringing a little bit more of his kingdom into this world. But there is a place. There is this place that Jesus said he was going to prepare for those who followed him. There is a place called heaven. And what I want to do this morning with you is I want to take you into and see a little bit of a glimpse of what that looks like. Because this picture, this thought, this understanding, this glimpse of heaven that we see in the scriptures is what has given the church hope through generations. This is what has given the followers of Jesus hope as they navigate and live and exist in a broken world, as they try to introduce a little bit of heaven into it. This is what gives us hope. I lost my dad 4 years ago, battled brain cancer and passed away. And my dad was a follower of Jesus. And so when you read these words, when you see the picture that is created in the scriptures of heaven, this gives me hope. That even though I think about him every day and I know that there are things that he's missed out on, it gives me hope that he's in the presence of Jesus. And there's something that's very, very reassuring to know that that exists. And so I want to take you into the words that we read from John. John was one of the earlier followers of Jesus, and he writes In the last book in the Bible, if you brought a Bible with you, if you want to grab one from in front, and it's not hard to find, just turn to the very end of it. You might find like, you know, an index or some maps or something. You know, just turn a little bit and you find the book of Revelation. And in Revelation, John, late in his life, is given a vision, given a glimpse into some things that John then records those things down. You have to remember, John is writing from a first century perspective. He writes in ways that are hard. There's a lot of hard things in Revelation, a lot of confusing things in Revelation. A lot of people who think they have it all figured out, and then, you know, then somebody else figures it out, and it doesn't even sound like the other, you know, so it creates a lot of confusion. People sell a lot of books trying to figure it all out. But at the end of this kind of glimpse that John receives from God, we see him starting to write a little bit about heaven. And I wanted to spend a little bit of time with you this morning looking at that, looking at these words and talking a bit about it and how that applies to us. And hopefully, it gives us a little bit of hope in our lives, in our journeys, and where we are. Revelation chapter 21, we'll have the words for you on the screen. This morning I'm going to read from a little bit different. Usually I read from the NIV. This morning I'm going to read from the New Living Translation. I just like the way that the words, I just like the way it kind of flows and how the New Living Translation shares that. So on the screen, it's going to be a little bit different than we normally do. But Revelation 21, verse 1, John writes, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the old heaven and the old earth had disappeared. And the sea was also gone." Now, as John starts to write this and he throws that phrase in there, "the sea was gone," for a lot of us, it's like, whoa, wait a minute. Why would you want to lose that? I like the beach. You know, that's my whole point in life, is existence, is work hard so that I can find a beach somewhere. And, you know, I enjoy that. You know, I like to be on the sand. I like to, you know, we enjoy that. We enjoy the water and the waves. Again, John's writing in first century world. For the ancients, the sea was a great cause of fear in their life. They had no way. They were not at a point in history yet. They were not at a point where they had the instruments to start to navigate that, the oceans and the seas. And so for them, the sea was a very great unknown and caused a great deal of fear for them in their lives. When they would travel, they were just starting to, the Roman Empire, you know, this time in history, they're starting to explore it a little bit more, but oftentimes they would just travel the coastlines. The idea of being out in the open water, not knowing what was there in front of them, caused them a great deal of fear. So for the first century world, as they're hearing these words from John, this would help them to know that point of fear in their life and not, you know, knowing where that all is and what's out there would give them a little bit of hope. And John gives us this picture that all the corruption, all the pollution, all the destruction of this world, all of that is over. Everything is renewed. Everything is restored. Which, you know, is maybe sometimes hard to understand. You know, you see the Grand Canyon, you see the mountains, you know, you see these beautiful places on this earth, and yet we know that there's still a lot of things that are broken. There are still a lot of parts of it that are messed up, that aren't the way that they should be. And John says there's going to be a point in time where all of that old is gone and everything is restored and renewed again. "And I saw the holy city, the New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven like a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband." All throughout the New Testament, there's this imagery of weddings and marriage, and they would use that imagery, they would use that picture to try to, you know, help us understand and the image of the relationship between God and the church. And so John, and as he's writing about this, kind of gives us that picture. And we all know what that's like to be at a wedding and to see the bride, you know, walk in, and, you know, she's beautiful and it's her day and it's exciting. And you know, some of you know what it's like to be the groom waiting for her to walk down the aisle, and you see her coming in, and it's like, oh, you know, you're so excited, and there's anticipation there. And there's excitement, maybe even a little bit of fear, you know, because you know that this is a big deal. This is a big moment. This is a big commitment the rest of our lives. And so John describes this moment as the holy city, this New Jerusalem, comes down, that it's like that moment that the bride is getting ready to walk down the aisle, the anticipation and the excitement that goes with that. "I heard a loud shout from the throne saying, 'Look, God's home is now among his people. He will live with them, and they will be his people. God himself will be with them.'" His home, his dwelling. from the very first pages of Scripture. The story, the theme that is woven all throughout the Scriptures is this idea of God wanting to have relationship with His people. That God wants to know you and He wants you to know Him. When Jesus described salvation, first week we looked at this, when Jesus described salvation, He didn't describe it as a place, He described it as knowing God. He wants us to know Him. He wants us to have that relationship with Him. And He's done all that He can in order for that to happen. And so John describes this moment where He makes His dwelling among us. What's really interesting is that John, when he starts to write his story of Jesus in the Gospel of John, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, he uses the same language that he uses here in the Gospel of John to describe what it was to have Jesus come to earth, that God had made His dwelling among us. He literally made His tent with us. He pitched His tent with us, that he brought His existence here with us, that God is here. And the same language John uses right here, His presence, His very presence will be with us, which is also a little scary if you think about it. Because we like to pretend and think that there are certain parts of our lives, there's certain parts of us that we can keep hidden. You know, we have our habits, we have our thoughts, we have our things that nobody else knows about. And we assume nobody does. And so the idea that God's presence, His very existence would be with us, that can be a little scary because there's going to be no hiding. There's going to be nothing that we're going to be able to keep hidden in that moment if this is true, that His presence will be with us all the time. He will wipe every tear from their eyes, and there will be no more death or sorrow or crying or pain. All these things are gone forever. John paints this picture that our resurrected bodies in this moment, all of that pain, all of that brokenness that we see in this world, all of it is over and done with and gone. There's no more cancer. There's no more diabetes. There's no more heart disease. No more headaches. There's no more depression. There's no more grief. There's no more loss. All of those things are done with. In this moment, as John begins to describe heaven, there's this beautiful picture that these things that plague us in this world, these things that hold us back, these things that cause fear in our life, that all of those things are completely gone and over with. You think about the mountain of wheelchairs that could be left behind, over and done with. You think about the vast mountains of apparatuses and oxygen tanks and all of the things that we see that we need in this world to have in order to exist and get, you know, over and through this life. And all of those things are done with and over in this moment. All of the parents who graciously loved and served a disabled child, or just giving everything they had, all of that in this moment. The adult children taking care of their aging parents, all of the things that we see in this world that cause us pain, all of the things that we see in this world that we look at and we know intuitively, we know this is not the way it should be. John says all of that is over. There's no more pain. There's no more sorrow, and there's no more tears. And the one sitting on the throne said, "Look, I am making everything new. Everything is made new. Everything is changed." And you read these words, and I have to ask you this question. You read these words that John gives, this glimpse that John gives us of what is to come, what is going to be there for us at the end. Where in this world are you finding hope like that? Where in this world, who is making a promise in this world like this kind of promise? We see and hear all kinds of empty promises. We see all kinds of empty rhetoric. We see all kinds of things that are done and said that they are doing. But where in this world do you find any kind of hope like what John, the picture that John is painting for us, the hope that exists that one day, all of this is made right and made new. And he also said, verse 6, it is finished. I'm the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To all who are thirsty, I will give freely from the springs of the water of life. All who are victorious will inherit all these blessings, and I will be their God, and they will be my children. What a promise. A promise to live, to lean on, to have in our lives. And then we read the but. Verse 8, But cowards, unbelievers, the corrupt, murderers, the immoral, those who practice witchcraft, idol worshipers, and all liars, their fate is in the fiery lake of burning sulfur. This is the second death. Duh. You know, it's like, oh, thanks, John, for the killjoy, man. I mean, this was looking so good. It was so sounding so awesome. And then, boom, he sticks that in there. And some of you, you know, the way you grew up in church, you're ready for that burning sulfur, you know, like that kind of thing. And this is hard for us because isn't God a loving God? Wouldn't heaven be the default destination of all people if God is such a loving God? And John begins to indicate to us that that's not the way this works. That this isn't how this is going to go. And we have to go back to what Jesus originally asked of people. He invited them to follow him. And the invitation was open to all people of all time, men, women, children, doesn't matter your past, doesn't matter where you've been, doesn't matter the things you've done, come follow me. But that choice ultimately is ours. And the reality of that, the reality of this idea of a heaven that we find, it's not that people are going to be left out of heaven, it's that we have a capacity. You and I have a capacity for evil in our lives. We can do our own thing. We can go our own way. We make our own choices. We can say whatever we want to say. We can do whatever we want to do. We can hurt whoever we want to hurt, including ourselves. And the reality is that this place that John describes, it's not the default destination of all people. We're going to dive into this a little bit deeper next week. We're going to look at some questions. We're going to try to answer some questions. We're going to work through this. A couple weeks ago, we gave you this little book, the big book, Eternity is Now in Session. This is like the little book for dummies like myself that don't really like to read. This makes it a lot easier. If you did not get a copy of this, we actually have some more copies available. We'd love to give them to you. They're just free. Just take them, stick it on a desk. Hopefully one day you'll pick it up and start reading. But it actually addresses this issue on page 54. If you got this book, you can go right to page 54. And John explores this idea a little bit more. And why? Why this would not be the default destination of all people? Because the reality is we don't have to follow him. We don't have to go with him. We don't have to put him in the lead of our life. But for those who do, there's this beautiful picture of heaven. John will then go on to describe the city itself. He'll go into great detail and take measurements and talk about different precious stones and how this looks and what it all, like the formation of it. And then a little bit later in verse 22, he says these words, which are pretty neat. He says, I saw no temple in the city, which again for us is not that big of a deal, but for a Jewish person living in first century world, that's kind of a big deal because they're used to the temple in Jerusalem, you know, the center of worship, that there was no temple. There was no need for that anymore, for the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are its temple. And the city has no need of sun or moon, for the glory of God illuminates the city, and the Lamb is its light. That God's light, his very presence, is everything we need. There's no more artificial light. There's no sun. There's no moon. There's no need for those things. Because John says the very light of God, the very presence of God, gives us everything we need in this place. So my guess would be that there's a lot of us theologically, there's a lot of us philosophically that believe that there is a heaven. There is a good place. But there's something better out there when this life is over. At least we hope there is. But the question that I have for us this morning is something a little bit more practical. It's not, do you theologically believe in this? We got to go beyond belief. It's not philosophically, do you believe that there is a heaven, that there is something better out there? The question is, do you live with that in view of your life? Do you live that way? Do you live practically live with the picture of heaven in front of you? Because if we really believed it, we would probably live a little differently. We probably would act a little differently. We probably would parent a little differently. We would probably serve differently. We would definitely worship differently in the light and the view of this place that John describes in front of us. It's not just about knowing God one day. Jesus says, no, we can know him now. That salvation is knowing God now. One day we'll know him even greater. But to want his presence, it's not waiting for that. We can have his presence today, which is scary because sometimes it's just easier to hide. And so as we read these words, I wanted to take some time this morning to read these words for you because I know that there are some of us that are in some really tough places right now. There's some of us that are in some really tough battles in our journey. And we have to know the hope that exists for us. We have to know what is being prepared for those who are following Jesus. That one day it is worth it. One day it is worth it. And instead of waiting for that day and that moment, that even now, in our lives now, in our journeys now, we can live with this picture in front of us. We can live in light of it.